Hey folks, have you heard of cancer-fighting foods? The American Cancer Society discovered diets rich in fruits and vegetables may actually lower your risk of cancer. Think about that for a second. That's really important. Hopefully you hear this and run to the store for 5 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. But if you're like me, you probably don't have the time to do that, right? So maybe you should consider adding Field of Greens to your daily health regimen. Each fruit and veggie in Field of Greens was doctor selected for studied health benefits. There's a heart health group, lungs, kidneys, and metabolism groups, even healthy weight. What your body needs is in each scoop of delicious Field of Greens. I take it every day. Sometimes I put it in a shake. Sometimes I put it in my egg white omelet in the morning. Field of Greens can help prevent, treat, and cure cancer? No, but it can powerfully help you out at your next checkup. Your doctor will notice your improved health or you're going to get your money back. Here's the most amazing thing about it. I started using Field of Greens a year ago. My cholesterol is down, my blood sugar is down, my weight's down, my health is up, my sleeping patterns are better, my metabolism is up. If you want to experience what I've experienced, go check out Field of Greens. Jump into the ring here. You're going to get an enormous benefit. And it's so simple. Single scoop, a couple of seconds, healthy lifestyle all day long. Now, thanks to our good friends at Brickhouse Nutrition, Field of Greens is going to give you a 15% off discount plus free rush shipping. All you got to do is go to fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JUSTNEWS for your discount. That's promo code JUSTNEWS at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com, promo code JUSTNEWS. Go check it out. And happy Sunday. This is John Solomon, returning to the John Solomon Reports podcast after a brief interlude. Last 10 days or so, I took some time off to take care of my ailing father, who passed away at the ripe old age of 82. He was a great man. He had been a law enforcement officer for 48 years, 5 decades of law enforcement service from state trooper all the way up to police chief. And throughout his career, he accomplished so many things. Today, I want to reflect a little bit on his legacy, as well as the legacy of one of my good friends who also served in law enforcement for more than 3 decades, Kevin Brock, former assistant director for intelligence for the FBI. You've heard him many times on this show. Sadly, Kevin had a recurrence, a sudden and severe recurrence of cancer, and he passed away on April 15th. We gave him a great memorialization in an obit the other day that really captured the essence of his career. He played such an important role in reshaping the FBI's intelligence gathering capabilities after the failures of 9/11 and to prepare the FBI to be ready to combat and stop terrorist attacks, not solve them after the fact, but stop them in advance while also protecting Americans' civil liberties, something that was very dear to Kevin Brock. Both these men, Jack Solomon, my dad, Kevin Brock, my good friend, both of them shared so many similar values. They were men of faith. They were men of public service. They put family first. They believed in the fair, honest administration of law, and they believed in right and wrong. They believed in morality, and that morality should drive law, that morality should drive society. And so I'd like to reflect for a couple minutes on both men's extraordinary contributions to our country. I'm going to miss my dad dearly. I'm going to miss Kevin dearly. I talked to them often on the phone. They were important players when it came to understanding how law enforcement worked. I'm a reporter. They were lawmen. They helped me understand the rights and the wrongs and the pressures that cops face that maybe a reporter or a member of the public or a politician didn't understand. And both of them accomplished so much in their careers. I want to start with my dad. And by the way, today we're going to play some of my favorite interviews with Kevin Brock. The most recent one, when he just a few short weeks ago sounded the alarm along with other former FBI executives, sounded the alarm about Joe Biden's open border and the extraordinary imminent present danger that was being presented by Joe Biden's border policies. Absolutely concerned that the next terrorists have already entered our country and perhaps more, perhaps Chinese men and others looking to do other long-term harm to this country as part of a geopolitical struggle with some of our major adversaries across the world. Let me start with my dad. My dad was born in utter poverty. His father died when he was 3. He was raised by his mom in the Catholic Church in a loving Irish Catholic family, and he made something of himself. He grew up in housing projects. He grew up in an era where welfare wasn't even really there yet. The welfare came from family members in the church, and then he repaid it as he worked his way through school He served in the United States Army Reserves. He was activated to active duty during the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. And over the course of his career, starting with becoming a Connecticut State Trooper, he rose through the ranks, trooper, detective, inspector, chief inspector for the state of Connecticut and its state's attorney's office in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And then eventually the police chief in Eastern Connecticut. He was the president of the Connecticut Chiefs of Police Association, installed one day before the terrorists struck on 9/11. And there's a great synergy between Kevin Brock and my dad in that both events, 9/11, shaped the latter ends of their careers in very significant ways. My dad's town, Eastern Connecticut, very small, only 7,500 people. It suffered some of the largest losses from 9/11, including the youngest child to die on the planes, a young girl from the Hansen family, 2.5 years old. And my dad spent a lot of time not only consoling and fighting for justice for the Hansen family, for their losses, for the son, the daughter-in-law, and granddaughter on that plane, but also to prepare law enforcement for a different mindset post 9/11, that you still had to solve crimes, you still had to put bad guys in prison, but you also had to have a skill set to detect coming imminent threats and to prevent them, stop them from occurring. Now, it's the difference between solving a crime the old-fashioned criminal law way and stopping a crime that could be a crime against humanity. And my dad's speeches in the aftermath of 9/11 were very powerful. They were very insightful. He still believed that even in fighting terrorism, we couldn't give up the civil liberties or the freedoms or the trust that Americans had to place in law enforcement to do what is right. And as I was thinking of some send-off thoughts for my dad before his funeral, I was struck by some very simple principles that he had. They guided his life. They guided his law enforcement career. They guided his leadership of the men and women in blue. I can't tell you the number of officers who came up. Scores and scores of officers, detectives, troopers who worked under my dad, who all said the same thing. He treated us like family. We were like his children. And he taught me to be the cop I am today. I heard that so many times. I always heard the story. He had our back. He always had our backs. If we did something wrong, we admitted it. But when we did something right or when we deserved to be defended, he was there to defend us. No throwing anyone under the bus. That was my dad's values. And my dad had these very simple values. Jack Solomon had these simple life values that drove his career, that drove his leadership skills, that drove his parenting of me and my extraordinary brother, Mark. And the first is, there's a God above, so live your life to make him proud. Do the things that are right. His second was, right is right. And wrong is wrong. There's no moral inclarity in the world. Right is right. Wrong is wrong. Try to do what's right. When you do something wrong, admit it, fix it, move on. He also believed in public service. He always would say, whenever you see a person in need, stop and help. That's your obligation as a human. And he trained his officers to do that. I can't tell you the number of times I'd be driving in the car with my dad for some social or school or other event. He'd pull the car over, put his flashers on because he saw someone on the side of the road in need of assistance. And he would use his police radio, call in help, get a tow truck. A couple times he and I changed the tire for someone who didn't know how to change their tire on a busy interstate highway. He believed that serving your community and putting others before yourself was important. And that drove so much of his career. The other thing he had, he was not a man who believed in looking backwards and lamenting and woeing in thyself. He had a very simple rule. The car of life, he told me, doesn't have a rear view mirror. Why? Because if God saw us staring in the rear view mirror, we'd either crash into the car in front of us because we weren't paying attention, or we'd miss an incredible right turn on one of life's adventures that God intended for us, but we weren't paying attention. So no looking back. Learn from your mistakes, move on, keep your eyes on the road forward, carpe diem the future. That was another one of his most important. And then his last one, which is one that he taught every basketball and baseball player he coached in Little League and grammar school, Catholic Basketball League, every officer that served under him, male, female, young and old, and of course his two children. He had this other lesson. It was called the mirror test. Can you look yourself in the mirror when you're shaving in the morning and be proud of that person? If not, he said, go back and change your life and come back and shave again. And don't stop until you get it right. You have to be honest and true to yourself. You have to be honest and true to the values. You have to live by the rights and wrongs of the world. And if you didn't, don't waste a moment. Correct your course before it's too late. Live a life worth living. He was born in other poverty, but he always said, I was born into the richest family you ever saw because we were rich with love. We were rich with appreciation. We were rich for all the things that gave us family and friendship and career and country. He was such a patriot. He loved America and he loved so much of the goodness that this country has. And today he couldn't understand why there would be generations of Americans yelling at and screaming and impugning this great country. He saw nothing but greatness in this country. Sure, there are flaws. He didn't support slavery. He knew it was wrong. He knew the Civil War was painful. He knew that different eras, the internments of the Japanese in World War II and others, he knew those were wrong things. But on the over-under, he believed America had all of the great values that a free society, a society built under God, had, and he was proud of it. And he was proud to be a law enforcement officer. At the end of his life, he was very concerned that perhaps more people would be scared to go into the same line of work he did. Young men and women wouldn't want to go through the troubles of being a cop. And one of the things we're going to do to try to address that concern is we're going to create a scholarship fund in my dad's honor, the Chief John F. Solomon Memorial Scholarship Fund, to help some students who do want to get into law enforcement, get through college, afford it, and get on the job to be good officers in the same values, in the same perspective that my dad had. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, some thoughts on Kevin Brock, the former assistant director for intelligence at the FBI, one of my good friends. He passed away April 15th from cancer at the young age of 69. We'll have some thoughts right after these messages.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
All right, folks, welcome back to the commercial break. Hey, real quickly, next Wednesday in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia, I'm going to be joining Rebecca Weber, my good friend, and all my friends at AMAC, the Association for Mature American Citizens. We're going to have a conference called Boot Camp for Boomers. If you are, I got a little gray hair in your hair, and you want to do something to save this country, be a patriot, you want to learn the skills to help perhaps get this country to close its border or protect parents' rights, or to protect our children, or to restore civil liberties that are sometimes being trampled, go attend this incredible event. It's on the front page of AMAC.us, Bootcamp for Boomers. Go check it out today and sign up. It's a really great thing. Next Wednesday, you can meet with me. I'll be up in Bucks County. Be sure to join in on that one. It'll be a lot of fun. All right, folks, we're going to spend a few more seconds reflecting on a second lawman who was large in my life, large on the public stage, whose career was deeply shaped by what happened on September 11th. His name was Kevin Brock. You heard him on this show so many times. He was an honest broker. He loved the FBI. He was proud of his FBI career, but he could call out the FBI for its failures, starting with Russia collusion. And then after Russia collusion, all of the other events that harmed the public's trust in the FBI, the January 6th investigation, the misuse of FISA in cases other than Russia, the concerns he had about the Ukraine investigation. He called aces, aces, spade, spade. He saw black and white. He shared the same values that my father did. And he also believed that the FBI could have special powers that could be carefully monitored, like FISA, like getting a warrant. He believed in getting a warrant for any American's phone records. Didn't feel like that step had to be skipped. He was an extraordinary patriot. And when he died last week, this country lost a very important voice, a guy who called balls and strikes evenly, was able to push his agency to the one he was so proud of serving in, to do better, to be better, to acknowledge mistakes, to not be arrogant. And I think he brought a tremendous amount of contribution to all this country. He honored the FBI, and he honored the civil liberties and the law and order nature that our values are rooted in this country. He was a law and order man, and that meant applying law and order also to the FBI. He wanted them to obey the law and to have the highest standards, not the easiest attainable standards. And I think that was something that made him truly, truly an extraordinary man. Today, we're going to pay tribute to Kevin and his many, many wisdoms that he shared over the years on this show, John Solomon Reports, a podcast, or the Justin News No Noise television show with Amanda Head and I. Some great moments with our good friend, the one, the only, Kevin Brock, coming up right after these messages. Godspeed, Kevin. I know you're with the good Lord above, as is Jack Solomon, my dad. I hope you two guys meet up there. I think you'd have a lot of great conversations. All right, we'll be right back after these messages.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back from the commercial break. Big moment on Capitol Hill today. Chris Wray testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. A lot of big issues that have the American public concerned, Congress concerned, the FBI concerned. But the hearing, I'm not sure, delivered the sort of results that Americans are maybe hoping they could get from it. Joining us right now, one of the most trusted voices in all of the law enforcement community, former Assistant Director for Intelligence at the FBI, and our good friend, Kevin Brock. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, John. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. This was an important day. At least it was supposed to be an important day. As you look out, give us a little refereeing of what went on in the hearing. Did we accomplish a lot in today's discussion?
Well, I think there was some missed opportunities on both sides, the questioners and on Director Ray's side as well. In the lead up to this, I think everybody was anticipating some real fireworks, and there were a few. But I think I found myself talking to the screen saying, ask him this question, or talking to Director Ray, Chris Ray, saying, answer it this way, and wanting to get more out of the exchanges. And so it was a little bit flatter than I thought it was going to be, but there were some key points. And I think, one of the things that probably jumped out the most, and a little bit of a missed opportunity on both sides. Obviously, the Republican side was questioning the director carefully on the possibility that the FBI, possibility or reality, that the FBI was recommending that social media, particularly Twitter, censor certain tweets and communications that were provably authored by Americans. I thought that Christopher Wray had an opportunity to explain to the American people, because not everybody is clear on this. You and I and everybody else who's in the Beltway and dissects every syllable of this stuff understands a lot of this, but not everybody does, is that the FBI does have a legitimate role in determining whether or not a foreign power, a foreign entity, is generating through bots and everything else these tweets that push forward their particular propaganda. Well, within the Bureau's remit, they do that, and they do a lot of it, and they do that well. The question is, are Americans who author tweets getting caught up in this and being recommended for censure by the FBI to Twitter. There's some indicators that that is the case or has been the case, whether it was mistake. Yeah. Whether it's been mistaken or sloppiness or something more nefarious. Chris Wray had an opportunity to explain that and say, look, we found these instances where it looks like we colored outside the lines. I've taken these steps to make sure that doesn't happen again. Mea culpa. But I didn't hear that. I think that was a missed opportunity. I think that, when Christopher Wray talked about getting input from the SBU and the intelligence services of Ukraine to censor certain Russian communication or tweets or social media posts, have the FBI do that. That's, I don't know, you're starting to get a little bit outside of maybe what the FBI should be spending their resources doing. And that didn't come across as something that would sit well, I think, with a lot of Americans. But the bottom line is Christopher Wray could not afford to look like he was obfuscating. And at times, it looked like he was just kind of dancing a little bit. He has a little bit of an unfortunate way about him. And if I was on his staff, I'd be advising him on this. He can come across as a bit pedantic, a bit elementary in some of his explanations. Well, that's classified information. And as you know, classified information, we can't divulge classified information. Well, everybody knows that. So don't spend time talking about that. Spend more time explaining, what it is that happened, what you can and can't do. And I thought there's some missed opportunities there.
There is a moment where Chris Wray says the FBI is not in content moderation, but that's simply not true. I mean, certainly foreign content moderation there is. And when you look at Elvis Chan's testimony, I mean, there was a system set up where they would flag things and then would go to headquarters for approval. If headquarters approved it, he would make the request. And there were times where some Americans were in there. They're specifically identified in the testimony and in the court records. But content moderation in general, it does go on. If it's related to foreigners, it isn't a problem. But if it's related to Americans, it is. It seems like he whisked off a tactic that actually is used by the FBI, and he could have explained it. Do you think most Americans are going to be concerned that Wray didn't really address that there is this sort of operation that does go around, maybe for good reason?
Look, the Republicans certainly are focusing on this, and with good reason. This is a topic of all the laundry list of complaints about the FBI and the concerns about the Bureau. This is one point that people will get. They'll understand. Look, we can't have the government, interfering with the way we exercise political speech in this country. So, he has to. Or, and let me put it this way: if he doesn't adequately address this and make the members of that committee satisfied that it's not going to happen again, then the FBI is looking for some serious reform that may impact the way they're able to do legitimate parts of their mission. And nobody wants that. We don't want an over rotation on this. So he has to come across as a little bit more reassuring that the Bureau is taking this seriously. They see where they may have made some mistakes, and they're going to reassure Congress. I would like to have heard him say, I can reassure you that this isn't going to happen again. And I didn't hear that today.
And by the way, there's some of the content moderation is legitimate. If he just acknowledged there was content moderation, but it's legitimate because it's not Americans, it's foreigners trying to influence with malign intention, I think it would be more believable to folks. But he just flatly said we're not in the business of content moderation. And there was a whole operation that, when people read it, obviously a lot of it appeared to be targeting foreign information, but it really was just a moment where the slap off didn't address the reality. By some of the reality could have been explained as, hey, this helps America. And if there were any instances of Americans, we're going to stop it. And it would have really helped the American people feel a little more comfortable. It just seemed like a missed moment. There's some other things that obviously questions he was never going to answer, but I just want to get your take on it. Christopher Wray said he wouldn't say if there were FBI informants in the Capitol riot mob. Usually the FBI doesn't talk about its informants. So I don't think that was a particularly big moment. Is there something he can do to address the concern that the FBI was somehow, in the crowd that day?
Well, I might disagree with you a little bit. I think that was a big moment because he answered that question twice. And the first time I go around, he was a little bit more precise on saying, look, he made a distinction between undercover agents, FBI agents acting undercover, blending into the crowd in an undercover capacity, and or informants, which the FBI refers to as confidential human sources. I can almost guarantee you there were confidential human sources in that crowd that have reported to the FBI, because the FBI has excellent coverage when it comes to violent extremists, right wing, ultra, I'm only using that term, but anti-government white supremacists who foment violence and preach violence. They have excellent coverage against those groups. And so you can almost assure, if they didn't have sources there when those representatives of those groups showed up, then shame on them. But undercover agents is a different animal. And when he answered later in the day, he said, he was asked point blank, can you tell us if there were any undercover agents at the January 6th protest? He says, I don't know. And that's stunning. That, frankly, I found that less than credible. And if he doesn't know, that is a huge disservice to him as director of the FBI, that he wouldn't know that. And I just find that hard to believe. So you're left with an impression that he is obfuscating there. So that was that he took a hit on that one. And hopefully they'll clarify that quickly.
Yeah. And it's sort of like the other answer. Sometimes there were just these brush offs when I think if he engaged in a legitimate conversation, he could have educated the American public. All right, we do this, we do that. And I'm not going to do it about specific things. It just seemed that there's another moment where he's asked about the 278,000 instances where American phone records were checked. This is a FISA court ruling, right? And he's asked, there's some different numbers out there. And he's like, I don't know. How could you not know about something that the FISA court slapped the FBI for? And by the way, that's one where there's bipartisan concern, right? Democrats and Republicans are both. It just seemed time and again, he was disengaged in having a conversation that would benefit all of us. The FBI is never going to be perfect all the time. We don't expect it to be. And it was very unexpected. I can't imagine a Bob Mueller or a Louis Freeh answering the way that Chris Wray did today. He looked a little bit too like he's kind of tired, or maybe tired of the idea of having to report to Congress. I don't know if that's a fair impression, but some people said that to me today. He looked like he had just had enough of these hearings. The job wears on you over a period of time. Does he still seem to have the chutzpah to make sure that Congress and him can work together?
Well, let me comment on the first thing you said first, and then I'll address the second. I agree with you, and it was you said it very well. This was a missed opportunity. People don't understand what Section 702 is. They keep throwing it around. Well, Section 702, price authorization, we've got to authorize that before the end of the year. 99% of Americans have no idea what they're talking about. This was an opportunity to explain what that is. And it's a very simple section of the Patriot Act. It basically says it allows NSA to tell the FBI when an American phone number was in contact with a known or suspected terrorist overseas. You'd think, we want to know that, obviously. And sometimes it could be a wrong number. Sometimes it could be a sister that they need a recipe for. Who knows? But it's something to be followed up. And in the days after 9/11, everybody was jumping up and down and wanted these things followed up on. Well, now 20 years later, things have cooled down. And now they're looking closely at, well, how many times exactly did the FBI get these numbers? And they're staggering number of phone numbers. And so, they're trying to paint this perhaps a little bit more nefarious than it is. But I think Christopher Wray had an opportunity to say, look, there was X 100,000 numbers that we looked at. This is what we found. This is the type of thing we're finding. This is why it's valuable. We're not spying on Americans, telephone conversations that have nothing to do with terrorism. He just could have taken that and really reassured the American people about how that program is run. Now, if the IG found certain misuses in the way that the numbers were accessed or provided to the FBI, say, we've taken that in on board. We've corrected that. Here's how we've corrected it. It's not going to happen again. You know, it was just we got administratively sloppy over the years, and we've tightened that up. People want to hear that.
Yeah, no, listen, it derives a lot of credit, but they feel better then. They're like, okay, the guy's on top of it.
Right.
It was just another moment. And by the way, that is one of the findings in the FISA court and in the IG, which was that there were times where phone records were accessed and they just simply didn't follow the FBI's own rules. I mean, Chris Wray made some better rules for this. They still weren't being followed. He could have just addressed that straight up. It just seemed like another moment where like, oh gosh, there's a really good answer here. Could you give it to us? And it didn't happen again.
Yeah. And I think he can be more transparent about consequences when that happens. Now, when I was in the FBI, if you messed up, you got at least a letter of censure in your file and it said, you know, naughty boy, don't do that again. And or it could be worse. If you really messed up, you could get days off without pay and, you know, that type of thing. You can, without damaging reputations or indicating who was disciplined, you could say, look, we found instances where there was noncompliance or lax performance. We've issued letters of censure to 54 people, explain and reassure that you're on, as you say, you're on top of it. So
it would make a huge difference to most Americans. I mean, that's the thing about it. And to many members of Congress, I think that's all they were looking for today.
Yeah, that's right. And as you point out, on both sides, everybody's concerned about seven. And I'll tell you what, if 702 gets thrown out willy-nilly because of you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And, because some of those phone contacts do lead to legitimate investigations that need to be followed up on. So,
yeah, I remember when the first people approached me in the spring of 2017 to tell me that, hey, this whole Russia collusion thing is a dirty trick. And their concern in coming forward to me late at night when I was just getting into my driveway was, these tools are so important. And if we lose them because they were abused, you're not going to be safe at night. You're not going to sleep as well as you sleep now because we won't be able to protect you from terrorists or foreign intelligence agents. And I remembered their motive in coming forward. They wanted me to know that, hey, these tools are good, but if we lose them because we abuse them, it's going to be bad for the whole country. And that debate, I think, has really gotten lost in all of this. There is a good middle ground where this can be resolved. Confidence can be restored. But the FBI hasn't, I think, signaled to those who are concerned enough. They get it. Hey, and they are serious about it. I'm sure they are serious about it behind closed doors, but they don't seem to convey it in public in a way. It's like, oh, you've got nothing to worry about. Do you think that there's a good possibility that 702 gets shut down or radically changed?
No, I don't think so. I think cooler heads will prevail. I think they don't want to be the Congress that shuts that down and then something bad happens. So I think it'll be now there may be some modifications or there may be orders to the FBI to report on a quarterly basis, you know, any misuse and that type of thing and put some more discipline around it. Absolutely. Bureau should welcome that. And they normally do. But to a larger point around this, whether it's 702 or whether it's there's other techniques. I thought it was an interesting exchange with the congresswoman from Washington State about using phone location data. So this is the cost when trust is lost. And thank you, James Comey and Andrew McCabe and Peter Strzok, because this is why their abuse led to a loss of trust so that legitimate tools that could actually save lives are being questioned as government overreach or suspected of being government overreach. And they're going to put tight restrictions or maybe even prohibit the use of legitimate tools like phone location data. They make it sound ominous. Oh, you can monitor where every American's going to be. No, they can't. A, they don't have the resources. B, they don't have the interest. But if Christopher Wray took a moment and explained and said, look, let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose there was a murder at 5th and Elm Street at 3 a.m. on Saturday morning. We know it took place at 3 a.m. on Saturday morning. We drop a geofence around that house, and we locate every phone that was in that 500-square-foot geofence at the time of the murder. Oh, there's five phones. Okay. then we can find out where those people were at the time and their leads. Now you go find the people and you interview them. Are they a suspect or not? So everybody, when you explain it that way, oh yeah, well, that's for a legitimate criminal investigation. Yes, that's right. That's how it will be used. But now it's, you know, it's painted because there's this loss of trust. Everything's ominous. Everything is Big Brother and spying on Americans. And that's an unfortunate consequence.
Yeah, no, it is. And the FBI doesn't want to engage in the conversation. It doesn't, at least hasn't been willing to engage in a way that could really change this debate to something that would grow trust. Today, that's what I kept thinking. Wow, what a missed opportunity for all of us to get on the same page and start, you know, address the concerns and don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I kind of get a sense that Republicans are going to be much more hard-lined after today than I expected them to be coming out of the hearing. What was the most big surprise? I think if there may be a couple surprises, anything that surprised anyone, oh, that's something we got to keep an eye on.
Other than what we talked about, not too much. I think overall, though, look, we've got the clash of two universes here. We've got the political class, which is going to use oversight committee hearings for political reasons. We've got the FBI that is protecting information that may be evidentiary and so that they can pursue, criminal charges. Those two never will mix. So you're always going to have the tension between being able to discuss things that are legitimate for oversight purposes and not destroying the integrity or privacy of those who are under investigation and the integrity of the case that's against that. That'll always exist. But there's ways to explain things. The FBI can never appear like it's in a defensive crouch. It serves the American people. It has to come across as, look, this is the way we're doing this business. If it is unacceptable, like back in the 70s, they instituted the AG guidelines because it was unacceptable the way the FBI was investigating left-wing groups back then. And so then the FBI adapts. It's an organic institution. It's meant to change with the times. If the American people say, we don't want you doing X, Y, and Z, then the Bureau's reformed and it doesn't do that. The Bureau has to appear as though it's open to criticisms. It takes affirmative steps to address issues that attack the trust in the FBI and in the eyes of the American people, and should always come across that way. And today's hearing, it just everything was a little bit defensive, and the back and forth between the two sides was not heartening for anybody watching.
Maybe James Comey would be a little different, but a Mueller or a Louis Free or Judge Webster, those directors, no matter what the politics or the frustration of the moment is, they had a way of rising above and defending or explaining why Americans and Congress can still have Congress and the FBI. And I felt like Chris Wray just didn't have the energy or heart to do it. It just seemed as though he was going to play this game of, I'm sorry, you're just wrong and I'm not going to address it. And I think there was a moment where this could have been de-escalated, you know, for the good of the FBI and for the good of the American people. It's going to be interesting. I want to turn to one last issue because we haven't had a chance to talk about it. It came up, you know, in a sort of bombastic way with Congressman Matt Gaetz. The FBI 1023, it's sort of an extraordinary thing to think that since 2017, there's been this allegation out there and the FBI's response is, we're still investigating it in 2023. Is that possible? And is, you know, Kevin McCarthy today said, I'm starting to smell a cover up that maybe there was a protection racket going on somewhere in the judicial system. That doesn't mean the FBI per se, but the idea that an informant gave this information and the current FBI's response is, we can't talk about it because we're still looking at it. Does it really take 6 years to resolve whether the vice president, now president, was involved in a bribery scheme?
No, it doesn't. I can't think of an investigation. I was involved in some very complex investigations, and even some where it looked circumstantially like we had somebody dead to rights, and we were able to actually prove that they were innocent, and it didn't take that long. I mean, the FBI is good at what it does. They're good investigators. They're going to get their information very quickly. They have all kinds of court process to help them along in that regard. So, no, that's not a believable statement. There are other factors that are at play here, but I don't lay it all at the FBI's feet.
No.
The FBI, well, all they can do is present. The DOJ has to prosecute, and that's where it gets political. Now, all of this spans two administrations, so I can't speak to what the motivations were at any given time regarding allegations and what a given United States attorney is going to do or not do. And now you got the special counsel and David Weiss. It's puzzling to me as it is to the members of Congress. I think that Christopher Wray could take steps and properly behind closed doors to explain what's going on, what they ran into, and I think that would go a long way towards serving the oversight. You know, there are still potential. Obviously, there's a potential concern that the president and his son took money in a quid pro quo scenario with a foreign power. There hasn't been a lot of movement out of DOJ to build confidence that they're really taking it seriously. Obviously, the plea agreement with Hunter Biden looked crazy suspicious, and a lot of questions were left on the table. My first one, John, and you and I have talked about this many times. Why wasn't he charged with Foreign Agent Registration Act? At minimum, you know, he obviously was working on behalf of a number of foreign entities. I mean, the FBI opened up Crossfire Hurricane on no predication for a fair case. And here you have adequate predication for a fair case. Clearly, and that they weren't even considered as charges. Why is that? And so, you know, these are things that and then what about the taxes? So nobody's ever said, has he had to pay those taxes?
He hasn't. In fact, the IRS agent, I interviewed him. He said that the IRS, he is certain the IRS knows for sure that the 2014 taxes on the Burisma money, that Hunter Biden has never paid the tax money, even though the FBI and the IRS together got a document in which it showed that Hunter Biden knew all along he hadn't paid taxes on it. And he was being prodded in 2017. Hey, you better get right on this, kid. You got to update your taxes. Most other tax defendants, if you had an email saying he knew all these years he hadn't paid it and he still hadn't paid it, it seems as though that would have been charged, right? They wouldn't have let the statute of limitations after they had a tolling agreement expire. When you look at the body of evidence, are there the legitimate questions about favoritism here?
Well, it certainly appears that way, because how do you incur millions of dollars of tax liability and then plea down to two misdemeanors and restitution's not even mentioned? I mean, in any white collar investigation, there's always restitution for the ill-gotten money. So that's ill-gotten money. Where's the restitution on that? And I mean, it's quite a return on investment for a couple million dollars. You get to plead to two misdemeanors where you don't do jail time. They're not a bad strategy for avoiding taxes. But everything looks like there was special favors exercised simply because their last name is Biden and Joe Biden's the president of the United States. That's clear appearance. There's no way around it.
Yeah. And so I think we're going to learn a lot more, too, in the next few weeks, particularly when Hunter Biden's business partner, if he does, Devin Archer, testifies. I think we're going to really learn how the dynamic worked between Joe Hunter and the other business partners. And that may fill in some of the blanks. It might make us even less comfortable. We'll have to wait and see how that goes. Kevin, it is such an honor to have you on. We always get common sense. We get calm, smart, wise assessment of what's going on instead of all of the fireworks that we sometimes get in Washington that don't get us anywhere. What an honor to have you on the show. Our audience just loves you. And what a great conversation today.
I'm honored that you asked me. Thank you, John. It's always good to talk to you.
Thanks for making sense of it all for us. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back. He served as the FBI's Assistant Director of Intel and can talk about this FD 1023 form, the Bureau's processes, and a whole lot more. Kevin Brock, it's great to see you again, sir. Can't wait to get your insight into all this.
Thank you, Amanda. It's great to be with you. Hi, John.
So John was just enumerating some of the big bombshells in this document. And for months now, I think we've all been kind of prognosticating about the information therein. And then obviously it was released in black and white form for everyone to see. As you read over this document, I think it was four pages or so. What were some of the top lines that you saw? Anything shocking, surprising that you didn't know before? Anything that you think is probably the most important for the American people to know?
Well, the biggest surprise is that it's been released publicly. This document is very damning for Biden's, obviously. It is source reporting from a source that's been characterized as trustworthy and reliable, that the Bureau has had some kind of a relationship with over a period of time. But the bottom line, the document contains more than ample predication for an investigation of Joe Biden for a bribery statute violation, 18 USC 201, where a public official is precluded from taking anything of value in exchange for providing some type of act that he performs under his official capacity. And this, what's outlined in this CHS reporting, contains all of those elements. So the duty of the FBI was to take that apart and determine whether or not this was valid information, and then launch an investigation to determine whether or not Vice President Joe Biden took a bribe, essentially, back in 2015, 2016 timeframe, when he and established that the quid pro quo actually did occur, where, according to the CEO of Burisma, they wanted a specific investigation into that company ended so that they could launch an IPO in the United States. Joe Biden went to the Ukraine, and something that's fairly unusual for a vice president to get involved in the criminal prosecution dynamics of a foreign country, and insist that the prosecutor bringing that case against Burisma be fired. And he was, because the vice president used leverage of U.S. loan guarantees to make that happen. That certainly walks and talks like a quid pro quo, where the Burisma is alleging that they paid up to $10 million to Hunter and Joe Biden, and got a favorable outcome like that. So it's a very damning document on its face.
Kevin, I want to talk about how the FBI would go about handling a document like this. And FD 1023 is a raw report coming in from an informant, so it's the beginning of a process. But at the moment that information comes in, the FBI already had a couple of very important things in their possession. They had the videotape that I made public in the spring of 2019, where Joe Biden brags that he did, in fact, fire Shokin, and he used a $1 billion loan guarantee to achieve that. The old famous son of a bee quote that we've all seen time and again. And they also had a pattern of payments that they first got when they arrested Hunter Biden's business partner, Devin Archer, and they saw this $3.7 million of money flowing into Hunter Biden's accounts from Burisma. So you have establishment money flowed, and you have the father who's accused of this making a brag that he did something that would have been beneficial. That plus the informant, would that have been enough to go from preliminary to opening a full criminal investigation?
You have enough here for a full field criminal investigation, no doubt. But beyond that, we have assertions by the CHS that the CEO of Burisma, Zlochevsky, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, tape recorded a lot of the conversations that he had with Hunter Biden, to include two conversations directly with Joe Biden. The FBI needs to know what's on those tapes. We don't know whether or not they took steps to interview Zlochevsky, or whether they have those, whether he turned over those tapes or copies of those tapes to the FBI. That's a key piece of evidence, obviously. If they were in possession of something like that, you'd think a case would have been brought to the grand jury to pursue an indictment. So we don't know where that stands right now, unless, John, you have other information along those lines that I'm not privy to. But there's more than enough here to do a full field investigation into the Bidens, using every tool that the FBI has at its disposal to conduct that investigation.
Wow.
Kevin, using those tools, I mean, it's been widely reported that this confidential human source is someone who is reliable, reputable, someone who's very, very trusted, and has been on a number of occasions. But at the end of the day, when you get down to the nuts and bolts, without any tangible or material evidence, it's just Joe and Hunter Biden's word against this confidential human source. Using the tools that the FBI has at their disposal, what would they need to find specifically to actually nail something down legally?
Well, Department of Justice will have a high bar on a bribery case against a public official, particularly with one as high profile as Joe Biden. And as you point out, Amanda, that they're not going to settle for just circumstantial evidence. The source has been characterized as reliable and trustworthy. As you read through the reporting, he obviously has impressive access among elites over in that country and elsewhere in Europe. So this is not a run-of-the-mill informant. This is somebody that's got some standing in the community and some credibility. Plus, the source knows that, Zlochevsky has alleged that he has tape recorded everything. So he's not going to report things that could later be disproven. Excuse me. So the most any time an investigator can get audio verification of a conversation, that's the finest piece of evidence short of a confession that you can come up with. So that's why that's important. If they conducted an investigation and used the source going forward since 2020, maybe asking him to record conversations, they may have done that and gotten further evidentiary information from players at Burisma. Whether or not the source was able to approach Hunter Biden, we don't know. There are a number of logical steps that an investigator would try to take to nail down the veracity of these allegations. The other part is they're going to have to prove that money exchanged hands. Yep. And they're going to have to show a money trail and dig in that regard. The Bureau's very, very experienced at doing that type of thing. So a large part of the investigation would be trying to follow the money.
That leads me right to my next question, Kevin. I appreciate you saying that. There is the very last paragraph of this memo refers to some Ukrainian business associates that are also in this that had ties to a blockchain cryptocurrency sort of thing. And just before that, there's a claim that Zlochevsky or one of the Ukrainian officials said it'll take 10 years for them to find the money trail that led to Joe Biden, the five and five. They talk about 5 million to both Bidens, a total of 10 million. When the FBI writes something down like that, hey, there's a person that's tied to this that has crypto blockchain, that seems to be one of the places where they may have a lead to go look for the money. Are we reading the document the right way?
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to consider the possibility the payment was made in some type of alternate currency, particularly if they felt like, and the Bidens may have insisted on this, if they felt like this is getting close to violating the bribery statute. Using cryptocurrency back in 2015, 2016 was still kind of new and leading edge. The advantage of cryptocurrency is it does afford a degree of anonymity, but there's still money trail. It's a ledger-based system. So any payments, once you know who's making the payment and you've got the Bitcoin numbers, you can follow that money and you can see how it is laundered, how it's cashed out and converted back into normal cash and where it goes from there. So it's not impossible to follow cryptocurrency trails.
Wow. Yeah, that's going to be a fun thread to yank on. We've just got about 20 seconds left, Kevin. I wanted to ask you, if this was any other president, like, I don't know, say Donald Trump, if it was his son, Don Jr., even his son-in-law, Jared, would this have been handled differently, you think?
Well, that's the buzz in Washington, D.C. right now, Amanda, as you know, that everybody's concerned that there's a dual system of justice, depending on which political party you're affiliated with. It's my fervent hope that it would be handled equally both ways.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome back, everybody. As you all know by now, my co-host, John Solomon, has been hot on the Biden corruption investigation trail for quite some time. And with Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer joining him, ever since the GOP took over the House, we are unraveling many more details even faster than what the Bidens could have ever expected. So just last night on our show, Congressman Comer declared that the DOJ and FBI have not cooperated and have obstructed every step of the way. And it begs the question, has the FBI always been this way, or have top level leadership recently adopted corrupt practices that filtered throughout the rest of the agency? Joining us now to walk through all of the latest is the FBI's former assistant director of Intel, Kevin Brock. Kevin, great to see you, sir. Welcome back.
Great to see you, Amanda. Thanks for having me. Hi, John.
Yeah. We are happy to have you. And, you know, I think much like COVID and the vaccines, whereas it caused a lot of Americans to start to question governmental health agencies and big pharma, there have been a number of instances, unfortunately, with the FBI over the last 5-10 years or so that have caused people to really question their long held high esteem that they had for the FBI. So, you know, with all the corrupt practices we've seen, of course, the FBI memos, the whistleblowers and their claims, Christopher Wray possibly lying to Congress. Is this, humans are fallible. We are political people. I know that people have always had political opinions, including FBI agents, but it seems to have reached a fever pitch. Is that the case?
It sure has, undoubtedly, more than I had ever seen it in my, 24 years in the FBI or predating that. You know, I've said this before, I'll repeat it. The number one job, I believe, of the FBI director is to make sure that the American people trust the FBI and that it is viewed as an objective, unbiased investigative agency. If we don't have that, then it's an imminent threat to our democracy. So it's vitally important. And we're seeing indications that lead people to believe that there's two tracks of justice in the country. And it's hard to deny that when you really parse out the facts, as John has done over the years. You're wondering, okay, you've got all this investigative activity against people associated with the Republican Party or conservatives. Where is the corollary? Why aren't we not hearing equally as aggressive investigations against those who hold Democrat or liberal or leftist views, most notably Antifa and others? So, Amanda, you're exactly right. This is a major raging wildfire in front of the FBI that they have to take steps to quell. And comments of, we can't comment on an official investigation aren't going to hold water anymore. There's going to have to be an expectation of doing better. And I've maintained, and I think Robert Mueller actually flirted with this for a while, that when it comes to a high level public corruption cases, that the Bureau's policy does shift and that they acknowledge that there's an investigation that's ongoing because it's in the best interest of the people of the United States. I'd like to see that policy carried forward.
I think there's a lot of people that'd like to see the policies of Robert Mueller back at the FBI. It ran differently than it does today. There's just not any doubt about it. Kevin, I want to ask about something that seems like an extraordinary unforced error. We had testimony from Director Wray. He said, listen, the Richmond anti-Catholic memo was an isolated, isn't a single FBI office. And they had a document they gave Congress. They redacted out the information. When they unredacted it, it turned out there were multiple FBI offices involved in the early part of forming in not only forming the memo, but forming an investigative plan to act on the memo. Directors don't make mistakes like that. It seems like an unforced answer. Why not just tell the public the truth the first time?
Yeah, it appears that in the memo itself, it references information that Richmond got from Portland FBI and Los Angeles FBI. It doesn't go into detail as to what that was. Matter of fact, the whole memo really doesn't go into detail to substantiate some of the allegations that they're collecting information or indicators that radical violent extremists are interested in, let's say, infiltrating what right. is referred to as the radical traditionalist Catholic, which is a term that was invented by the Southern Poverty Law Center, as far as I can determine. There's, you know, there's no such thing as that in the church. And so, yeah, this was a dumpster fire from the get-go. I think the director admitted that, but you don't want to mess around with this. You don't want to play cute with it. You know, yeah. if it is a mistake, admit it's a mistake. Make sure that everybody understands it was a mistake and it's not going to be replicated and not acted on. You know, traditional Catholics don't need the FBI, conducting investigations or even trying to recruit confidential human sources within that community. That's just it's a distasteful bridge too far.
Yeah, good point.
Kevin, I want to ask you about what we are learning out of the Biden family, their businesses, the money gained from that. Biden family has done a remarkable job of leaving breadcrumbs, whether it's on the IRS side, where they are lining up a lot of the things that they found with Hunter Biden's own book, or some of the investigations and the results that have come forth from House Oversight and Judiciary with respect to what was found on the laptop. John's been reporting on elements of the laptop as well. If you were one of the investigators on the Senate side for Senate Intel or on the House side, Oversight, Judiciary, any of these committees that are looking into this, now, you know, with what has come out, with what's transcribed, transpired so far, where would you tell them to look next?
Well, I think that with the amount of money that they're uncovering, with the structured money laundering that's obviously been set up, we can conclude that Joe Biden and his family were for sale. And there's certainly, you know, reasonable suspicion to investigate based on those indicators. But I'm thinking just the staggering amount of money and hiding that amount of money as an investigator, I'd want to know, does this conspiracy go broader than just the Biden family? Are there others in that administration at that time that were benefiting from all of this activity? So I'd widen the scope a little bit. Start really digging and following the money wherever it leads. And I frankly wouldn't be surprised if this has a broader parameters.
I wanted to ask about FCPA. That was a law that the Obama-Biden years, actually the Justice Department did a good job raising the profile of that, looking at foreign bribery where money was changing hands. Is there elements of FCPA and the evidence that now we have public?
Well, absolutely that, as well as the FARA violations that were never charged. And then at its heart, the guts of it is, Title 18, I think it's 262, the bribery charge, the bribery statutes. And now, you know, can we even believe that there's anybody in America that doesn't think that the Biden family was involved in corrupt practices? Even the Democrats are coming around to realize that they've got to come up with flimsy excuses such as illusion of influence and that type of thing, but no criminal activity that doesn't get them away from the statute. There's still a lot of indicators here that the Bidens are in trouble. Now, whether anything's going to be done about it, John and Amanda, I don't know. You know, we've got a track record here lately where people just aren't held accountable. You know, whether these glaring blinking red lights of corruption with that family is ever brought to justice is going to be a very interesting thing to watch.
Kevin, very quickly before we go, especially on the heels of Sound of Freedom, the movie about human trafficking having so much success, we've heard mainstream media and a lot of people criticize the fact that that movie, you know, portrayed it to be worse than what it actually is. And I'll couple that with the notion that the rank and file members of the FBI do good work every single day. We just found out recently that the FBI found 200 sex trafficking victims, 59 missing children in a large scale sweep. They're still doing the hard work, even though the people at the top, the brass, plenty of room for criticism, but the rank and file men and women, they're still doing really good police work.
And we lost two FBI agents last year because of one of those cases, and that led to the operation that was concluded this week between the United States and Australia, and is on the heels of another operation that happened a couple of weeks ago, operation, I think it was called Cross Country. This is a wildfire. I haven't seen Sound of Freedom, but I can almost assure your audience that whatever they saw there, it's worse in reality. Yeah. And human trafficking, the exploitation of children is so mind-numbingly devastating.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back after these messages.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
I normally find bras to be so uncomfortable and constricting, but Skims has changed that. You know I love Skims underwear, so I finally tried their bras, and Skims has delivered again. Skims bras are worth the hype for the amazing shape and support they give, but what I wasn't expecting was how comfortable they are too. I've tried so many bras in the past, and the main issue that I have is that they weren't supportive enough, to the point where they felt slouchy. I love my Skims wireless form bra because it's so comfortable and supportive. The older I get, the more I care about actually being comfortable in what I wear every day. And with my wireless form bra, I no longer have to sacrifice my comfort for the support I need. Shop Skims bras at skims.com, now available in 62 sizes, 30A to 46H. Plus, get free shipping on all orders over $75. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know we sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select our show in the drop-down menu that follows.
Welcome back, everybody. A former U.S. attorney told the House Judiciary Committee the FBI kept even the mere existence of the Hunter Biden laptop from his investigations. And a new letter authored by Senator Chuck Grassley's as it regarded the FBI having more than 40 informants on possible criminal activity involving the Biden family. And lucky for us, we are rejoined by one of the good ones who has risen through the ranks at the FBI. He is the former assistant director of intelligence and a friend of our show. We love having him on. Kevin, good to see you.
Nice to see you, Amanda. Thanks for having me. Hi, John.
Hey, hello.
Kevin, I want to press in on a very important article that you wrote last week regarding Hamas and their style of attacks and the possibility that it could happen here, because I think that we here in America, we suffer from normalcy bias and possibly recency bias, because even 9/11 was 22 years ago. And a lot of those factors that contribute to our confidence that it's not going to happen here, competency at the State Department, strength of the executive, pragmatic foreign policy, strength of military, a lot of those factors have been compromised. And one of the things that you honed in on in this article was a new tactic by Hamas, these paragliders. Now, we have already seen the Biden administration allow a Chinese spy balloon to fly practically clear across the United States. And I think about, you know, outdoor amphitheaters, Soldier Field, NFL stadiums, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade coming up next month. And that concerns me a lot, because we have a lot of open air things that happen here in the United States. And if they can do it there, and if Joe Biden allows the balloon to happen, it can happen here.
Amanda, exactly. And the concern that I had after listening to President Biden's speech last week was that we're focused on the Middle East, on the Ukraine. And we know now that there has been a intentional surge of military aged young males from countries that are either state sponsors of terrorism, or up to 170 of them who were on the terror watch list that were confronted at our borders. Those are the ones that were caught. We don't know about who else might have been able to get into the country. When we have that kind of vulnerability, then the attack from Gaza on 10/7 becomes even more jarring. It was a kind of a new strategy where masses of young men came in well-armed and just started shooting up civilian populations. Could that happen here? Well, in light of the information that we have, the sudden surge of individuals coming from hostile nations, I think we have to be wary about that. And as I mentioned in the article, I would like to see the FBI and the CIA determine whether there's operational significance behind the surge. And then let's find these people and make sure that they're under investigation and can't cause these kinds of problems. Because as you point out, we have a number of soft targets in this country where like the attackers from Gaza, know that the population would be less armed and less able to defend itself. And that's a scary scenario.
Yeah, it really mm-hmm. is. Director Ray, I think, signaled that he is concerned. He was with all of the leaders of the Five Eyes countries, gave a pretty compelling interview and statement. What's going on behind the scenes? Typically, what would the FBI be doing at this moment, knowing that there is this potential for an operational threat?
Yeah. So ideally, and the director commented on the threat of lone wolves, but this goes beyond that. This would be an organized attack by individuals who would have been placed in the country as an attack cell, who would come together en masse like they did in southern Israel. That's my concern. If the FBI logically would want to know, all right, who has been confronted at the border, and then get information as to where those individuals are now, and then launch a nationwide investigation through its 56 field offices to develop sources to determine who is here now that we may not be aware of from specific countries. The FBI knows how to do that. They should do that.
Yeah, important.
Kevin, if we can't identify these people within our borders, then Americans need to know how to protect themselves and what to do in instances where a threat exists. And I think about, you know, you no longer active within the FBI, and John Story, former USA Brady, as investigating the Bidens, you know, former. And I keep hearing this, and I just keep hoping that not all the good guys are former, that they are still active in their organizations. But with respect to the threats that we have here on the ground, if you were still in the FBI and you were putting out a memo to Americans saying, this is what to look out for, this is what to avoid, what advice would you give them?
Well, obviously, the issue of guns in the United States is a very controversial, very emotional issue. Just last night, the horrible shooting in Maine, you know, is galvanizing the country one more time. But the jarring thing about what happened in Israel was that Hamas knew that their victims were going to be unarmed. Inexplicably, mm-hmm. the Israeli government policy restricts private gun ownership in that country, despite the fact that all of their adults have had military training and would know how to use weaponry. So I would never take a position that Americans shouldn't deserve the opportunity to be able to defend themselves, particularly from a terrorist attack like this, where you're out and minding your own business and conducting yourself without thinking that there's going to be a fearful attack. Americans have to be wary. Unfortunately, that's the situation we're in right now. And I would never counsel people to not arm themselves if they felt like they had to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kevin, I want to turn just quickly to the Biden investigation, because there's these pretty extraordinary revelations. At least they feel extraordinary to everyday people. But
40 informants or more than 40 informants providing information of possible criminality on Joe Biden, and then a claim that FBI whistleblowers don't think it was treated seriously or thoroughly investigated. And then the U.S. attorney, Mr. Brady, saying the exact same thing, which is, hey, I actually did some corroboration of some of the stuff. The FBI didn't seem to want to cooperate with me. I know you've had a chance to look at some of that. Your takeaways from those two explosive revelations.
Well, it's getting more and more difficult for Americans to believe that there's something wrong with the system right now. You take the totality of what you just talked about, 40 informants, which by the way, that's an amazing amount of informants working one issue in the FBI. That's, you hear about that when it's a nationwide investigation of some large criminal gang or something like that. So I'm wondering whether there might be a garble there, and that it's not 40 reports, but it's if it's 40 discrete confidential human sources, that's an indicator. That's an indicator that there's information out there that people want to provide about wrongdoing. When you have the number of whistleblowers come forward that we have that are worried that certain information is not being treated the way it should be, whether it's FBI agents or IRS agents, you look at the totality of that, and then you look at the totality of the reporting that we've had and what's been reported that's come off the Hunter Biden laptop. There is more than ample indication that there may have been criminal violations by members of the Biden family, to include the president himself, that deserves robust investigation. But that's not what we're hearing. And there's concern among people who've been involved in these investigations, people trying to do the right thing, people, you know, line investigators and line AUSAs trying to push this investigation along, but being met with resistance. Why is that? I hate to say it, but I'm wondering whether we can come to the conclusion right now that this Department of Justice is just not going to pursue the Bidens. It's not going to happen. And logically, you look at a DOJ that was willing to do a search warrant raid of a former president who is going to be the political adversary of President Biden in 2024. And you look at a DOJ that was willing to marshal to an early morning raid of journalists who were holding on to a $20 diary of the president's daughter, then right. you can reasonably conclude that we've got a Department of Justice here that's about willing to do anything on behalf of the president.
All right, folks, that wraps up another edition of John Solomon Reports, a podcast from Just the News. A big thank you to all the times that Kevin Brock came on the show. A big thank you to my father and Kevin Brock, Jack Solomon, Kevin Brock, two public servants, two men of faith, two men who believed in right and wrong, good and evil, and who lived their lives in service of this country. What a great way to celebrate this beautiful April Sunday. All right, we'll be back tomorrow, Monday, with a regular programming. Until then, God bless you and have a great night.